Well, here we are in another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the Sunday edition. Today, if you're listening to it on the Sunday when it was netcast, it is, let's see here, December 14th, I guess it is. Okay, I always get confused when I have the wrong calendar on the wall. We don't have a lot of material here this evening, and I'm going to probably make this short, but hopefully less painful. I don't want to drag it out. There's going to be a few interviews from Food Not Bombs. I may delve into the Huff meeting again, just to give you a sense of the cheerful chaos that seems often to ensue, but also provide some perspective into the lives of the folks that are there, and also some of the ongoing issues that are never getting answered, but keep getting raised. And we also are going to have a few flashbacks from nearly 30 years ago, 1997. I think it's going to be to September of 97, although I may also grab some fragments from earlier that summer. I'm not sure. But stay with me and you'll find out.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Okay, let's jump off with an article from the San Francisco Chronicle, December 12th, 2025. It's in the front page, and the headline is San Francisco Crackdown on RVs Making Slow Progress. Only three households out of hundreds have moved indoors since the ban took effect, by Lucy Hodgman. Every time Vernon Wayne Ayle II leaves his RV parked in the Bay View, he's afraid it won't be there when he gets back. The 54-year-old San Francisco native has been living in the vehicle since April, when a black mold infestation forced him out of his family home on Bayview Hill. Now Ayole is among hundreds of homeless people throughout the city trying to navigate San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie's new ban on RV parking since it took effect November 1st. The legislation pushed by Lurie and approved by the Board of Stupid Viper Supervisors, as they call themselves, created a new 2-hour parking limit for large vehicles parked on city streets. Lurie proposed the program as a response to both vehicular homelessness and neighborhood concerns about RVs taking up parking and illegally dumping on city streets. Residents of areas with a high concentration of oversized vehicles, such as Bayview Hunters Point, The Mission, Lake Merced, and Dogpatch, have called for action on the issue over the past few years. And, of course, action would be a very nice thing, but probably not the kind of action that this writer and the people who are pushing Lurie's program and got him to create it are not exactly what I would call sensible action. If San Francisco is anything like Santa Cruz, I fear it is, but they do have more resources, and there's also, perhaps more importantly, activists who are pushing back in the anti-fascist direction against Lurie and his bunch. But here, of course, in Santa Cruz, what they do is they simply try to run people away, out of town, ban them. They create some token facilities or some plans for facilities that can persuade the softer hearts on the Coastal Commission to say, well, the homeless people will not be able to get access to the coast that much anymore, and that violates the coastal ordinances. But as long as you have something for them to park somewhere, potentially to park, that'll be okay. So what we've had for the last couple of years in Santa Cruz is a program with a massive waiting list. There's only 20 or so vehicles able to take advantage of that up at the Armory. And the rest have this duck in and out of from dusk to dawn in city parking lots without really much in the way of any facilities, and also not really any way to really keep a budget together. If you're trying to live in an RV and struggle to do a work and a job at the same time, you can't afford to be spending gas moving your vehicle every 12 hours and then also trying to use it to get to work. So it's in San Francisco, I don't know, maybe they got better transit systems. I doubt that there really is a hell of a lot of difference. Although, you know, they have, well, you'll be hearing in this article about some of the supposed mediating or some way they tried to soften the blow of this latest ban. But here's some more of the article. The program just got off to a slow start in its first month. Just three of the 327 total permitted households had moved into housing as of December 3rd, city officials said. Now, of course, what's not mentioned in this article is how much housing was actually available. And that, of course, is the same perennial reality here in Santa Cruz that, you know, vacant housing is kept vacant for the benefit of commercial interests, real estate interests, simply bureaucratic obstructions and city oafishness, I would have to say. There's, in other words, there's vacant housing. It's just not being opened up to those who need it and those who could use it and use it profitably. That, of course, is requires probably a revolutionary movement to take over housing that is being wastefully used, or at least to begin to punish it, if you don't want to get revolutionary, with taxation that would require people to get their property, make it available to people in some way, to those who are willing to rent, and drop their rent somewhat so that people can actually use it. But that would be simply socialism, or maybe communism, or maybe anarchism, or whatever the ism you want to call it. But the renters have not been able to get together to make those kinds of demands in effective ways in Santa Cruz recently. Perhaps, I don't remember if they have in memory. We people continue to try, and I hope they do. Anyway, this program, only three of the 327 total permitted households in San Francisco had moved into housing as of December 3rd, city officials said. That's likely to frustrate RV dwellers and homeless advocates. Meanwhile, residents hoping for respite from the chock-a-block RVs, I'm not sure what that means, in some areas say they haven't seen a meaningful difference, with only six vehicles towed and 92 citations issued as of December 5th. Now, I want to point out this is, I guess this started in, I don't see a start date early in the article, but maybe I'll catch it later. The article was published, remember, on December 12th. So I know they're expecting lots of vehicles to be towed away in a week. I don't like talking about the stony hearts of politicians, bureaucrats, conservative residents. But, yeah, that's still how it looks to me, as usual. Anyway, for Aol, the fellow who's about to worries about not being able to go to a job because he's afraid he'll come back and his van will be gone. The process has been frustrating. He said the city missed him when it counted 501 large vehicles on city streets in May. As a result, he was denied a permit to temporarily shield him from parking limits. The permits give RV dwellers 6 months to relinquish their vehicles and move into housing or shelter, although extensions may be granted if housing placements aren't made by their expiration. But there's no indication of the availability of housing mentioned in this article. which makes me very suspicious that this is a way of sugarcoating what they're doing, claiming, see, all they have to do is move into housing. They're service resistant. You know, they want to break the rules. They want to do all their drugs outside and be crazy. Of course, the suggestion is that people in houses don't. It's ridiculous, but ridiculousness has never been never stopped cities from acting like fools or tyrants, unfortunately. It's people that ultimately stop that. I would say that to you listeners, keep that in mind. City officials granted 308 permits in San Francisco before the November 1st deadline, when traffic enforcement officers began towing and ticketing the remaining large vehicles parked on city streets. So it's been about November 1st, so it's been a couple months. And 19 additional permits between November 1st and last Friday, according to the San Francisco Department of Emergency Management. Well, one reason they may not be towing them is if you tow somebody's vehicle, they're going to be living on the street. And that's also even more visible, even more of a so-called health and safety hazard than people who are at least in their vehicles and taking their care of their private needs in various ways and not, littering the streets with their freezing bodies, which can be either, how are you going to explain that to the children, there's just a bunch of bums and drunkards, I guess, and junkies. That's, they're human beings who, I'm not going to go into that because you catch that kind of characterization. It's been done in societies throughout. It's being done, of course, in Palestine, where that's the justification for a massive genocide when people rebel. Continuing. Shiny blue permit stickers now dot the bumpers of many RVs parked off Ingalls Street. Aiello sometimes feels like his vehicle is the only one without protection. "I'm the last of the Mohicans," he sighed. He's in the process of appealing the city's decision, which requires documentation to prove his RV has been in the city since May. "The mood in the neighborhood has been tense," Aiello said, as RV dwellers anxiously await permits or housing placements, unsure whether they could return to find their vehicles ticketed or towed. But for almost all the permit holders, little has changed since the program began. 99% of them are still waiting for housing. "Throughout December, referrals will ramp up and placements will increase over the six-month permit window as permitted households work with case managers," said Jackie Thornhill, a spokesperson for the Emergency Management Department. I bet her housing doesn't depend on some case manager coming through at an uncertain and indefinite period of time in the future. In the meanwhile, she abandons her house to wait on the promise that there'll become some kind of action in the months ahead. Anyway, Jackie adds that households generally remain in their vehicles until they accept a suitable placement. And I don't know if that is in her power, see. If she could give them a promise that she will not be moved until there's a place for you to go, I think a lot of the resistance to the removal of encampments, whether on the ground or in vehicles, would stop. But of course, that's not happening at all. It doesn't happen in Santa Cruz. You get Jeremy Leonard and his crew going around claiming they're going to offer places for people. And some people get them, but many people don't. And that is also the word that goes around. That being the case, it's generally seems to be the case that they're not putting the money into the homeless services. They're putting the money into the buildings and the salaries of the people who are supposed to be providing the homeless services, who already have housing, who already have services they don't need more money for. They probably do need more money because of the ridiculous rents in Santa Cruz, but that's a whole different issue. Continuing with the San Francisco story, Thornhill said four total RV dwelling households had been chosen as candidates for housing and offered rapid rehousing rent subsidies. The program also plans to use permanent supportive housing, non-group shelters, and hotel vouchers to entice people to move. This month, the city plans to conduct another count that differentiates between permitted and unpermitted vehicles, Thornhill said. But how many housing opportunities are really available is not yet mentioned in this article, other than vague statements. Our goal is to house as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, Thornhill said, when asked whether the city expected to place the remaining permit holders by the six-month deadline. This is what now City Council member Susie O'Hara said 6 or 7 years ago when she was falsely reassuring the Camp Ross people that they would have a place they could stay where they were at, and then that there were, she's assuring the City Council that everybody had a place to go who was being evicted or moved out of Camp Ross when the city decided simply to dump Camp Ross in violation of the promises that they had given, that they were simply trying to clean the area up and people could temporarily go to San Lorenzo Park and then come back to Camp Ross. And that prompted, of course, the California Union of the Homeless to get an injunction that at least staved this off for a week until O'Hara lied in court and, or we might say give a misimpression in court. But anyway, persuaded the judge that there was adequate housing for people when the entire, I'm going to say the entire city in Santa Cruz knew there wasn't. I'm jumping back to Santa Cruz because that's where we live. And, of course, that's where most people who hear this netcast are. So, in any case, continuing with this fanciful story in the San Francisco Chronicle. Back in San Francisco, the three households relocated include two families and one individual, she said. A fourth placement is planned for later this week. They're talking of moving scores of people, but they can only put four into housing. The rest are going to face elimination of their vehicles or criminal penalties or fines. I mean, is how I'm beginning to, I'm seeing that what they're, I guess I'm wondering, is this what they're saying? Let's continue. City officials warned in October the new restrictions would not transform the situation overnight. Some residents in impacted neighborhoods say they've yet to see a meaningful change on the streets. These are the people who are in houses who are demanding that those give up their houses when those houses are homes on wheels. It's truly just been consistent, said Dogpatch Neighborhood Associate President Michael Berkowitz, who said he typically sees 10 to 12 RVs parked along a nearby stretch of Cesar Chavez Street. There are people in South Dogpatch who are frustrated because they thought the enforcement that things would be improved, but it's just status quo. Of course, by that he means all these people gone and their housing gone. And that's, I can understand, that's what he wants. Is that fair to the people that he wants gone? Is that fair to the other people in the San Francisco neighborhood? Is that generally fair? You be the judge. Let's see here. Aaron Phillips, the president of the Mission Dolores Neighborhood Association, said he's noticed slightly fewer RVs around the Mission District since the new restrictions took effect. I guess they're trying to scare people away. I think that's the plan. Still, Phillips would like to see the city give RV dwellers plenty of notice before their vehicles are towed. Wasn't that big of him? Then make it cheap and accessible to retrieve them. Have you ever had anything of yours towed and you're a middle-class citizen? You know how easy it is to get your vehicle back from a tow yard. Imagine how it is if you are living not just paycheck to paycheck, but one desperate momentary job to the next. And you can't, your ability to maintain a job and function has to do with whether you can have a private place, a bathroom to go back to, a shower facility if you live in your RV. Other cities such as Oakland and San Jose offer supervised lots where people can sleep in their cars overnight. San Francisco closed the only site of this kind in 2022 after pouring $18 million into the project and struggling to direct more than a fifth of its residents into shelter. So they weren't really doing it. They were simply herding people into one place so they could claim that they would have, first they could remove them from the neighborhoods and get the votes of the wealthier residents. And then the folks are out of the way. People in their RVs, are they going to complain? They'll complain, but who's going to hear them? Are they going to get together and complain, I guess, is really the question. Some advocates are hopeful that the city can open another supervised lot, especially for single adults who might prefer to remain in their RVs. Why haven't they done so? It would be an interim, safe, stable place until they can find permanent housing, said Jennifer Friedenbach, the executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness. It's the original modular housing. It's a great creative way to solve the housing crisis in a cost-effective way. Friedenbach described the city's RV program as Orwellian, you know, 1984-ish. She's concerned that it's added to the strain on the city's supportive housing resources, prolonging the wait time for families who have already been in shelters for months or years by allowing RV dwellers to skip the line for housing. This is a matter of crowding everybody into the same situation so they can fight each other while the politicians just go on their merry way. The city has set aside, that's my comment, not the author here. The city has set aside 165 rapid rehousing vouchers specifically for RV dwellers, with another 260 vouchers available for unhoused people in other living situations. But getting landlords to take these subsidies is an ongoing challenge. The city launched a new program last month that seeks to address that issue by offering 1 month rent payments to property owners who agree to hold a vacant unit while city staff works to match it with a household from the RV permit program. The program, funded by $450,000 in private donations raised by the Lori administration, is meant to prevent loss of income for landlords, those poor landlords, while ensuring more units are available for quick placement. Thornhill said last Friday there were multiple landlords in the review process, but could not confirm how many units the program had made available. Why not? Maybe it'd be embarrassing. The city has also launched a buyback program as an incentive to get people to relinquish their vehicles and move into housing or shelter. I would say, of course, if the shelter exists. But, of course, there's no indication in this article about whether the shelter exists or not. Since they don't mention it, I think it's fair to say before you steal somebody else's vehicular home, you better have damn well of a place for them to go. But of course, they don't. And they don't care. Because it's the law, you see, and they passed the law. Enrique Olivas, 66, plans to take the city up on this offer. Once he's offered housing, he'll turn in the RV where he currently resides with his dog, Suave. Other RV dwellers are more reluctant to part with their vehicles. Marie Vargas, 34, was wary when her now husband invited her to join him in a motorhome 3 years ago, but decided it was an improvement from the single room she was sharing with her mother and two brothers at the time. Now Vargas likes everything about the RV, from the privacy it affords to the community of other families usually parked on the block. She even reconnected with someone from her hometown in Guatemala who parks nearby. She spends most days in the vehicle with her 5-month-old Maclis, while her husband works as a street cleaner. With her permit secured, Vargas is waiting for a housing assignment, but she feels sad about leaving the vehicle that was her son's first home. Moving, she said, is the only option we have. Aol, meanwhile, is hopeful that his appeal will be successful so he can get on the housing fast track and move out of his RV as soon as possible. He's eager to regain some of the stability he lost when he moved out of his home last spring. I miss my nature. I miss being outside my koi fish pond, my apple tree, he said. I miss being able to come out of my apartment and just do the things I need to do. That's an article, San Francisco crackdown on RVs, making slow progress. Only 3 households out of hundreds have moved indoors since the ban took effect. And I suppose the good news, although I can't really vouch for it in Santa Cruz, is we had the last stupid viper supervisors meeting of the year. I do call them the stupid vipers, and have since the 70s. But that's not always true. I haven't heard of any renewed attempt to seize RV vehicles, but again, I haven't been keeping a very close eye or heard very much about citations against vans and harassment of people in vans. In fact, I'd appreciate it if anybody listening to this netcast who has any more information and who's interested in this issue, to get in touch with me at the Huff Line. That's Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 831-423-4833. You live in your van yourself? Are you interested in forming some kind of a van dwellers union? Have you had any experiences recently that we should hear about? Give me a call, 423-4833. So now let's join David Robics and I Tsuno in the Class War Zones guided tour, which is Robics' latest, or I should say both, Tsuno and Robics' latest sort of dropped album. We've been playing a lot of it. Here's some more of it. I've been running it by you on Sundays. Here's some more for you to check out.
For those of us who have been watching Western news coverage of global events over the past few years, there is this feeling often called a disconnect when it comes to flipping between coverage of Gaza and coverage of Ukraine. When Russian missiles strike Ukrainian infrastructure, the Western media and Western politicians immediately cry war crime and even genocide, on the basis that depriving the Ukrainians of access to the electrical grid is the worst thing anyone has done to anyone else in a long time. When Israeli missiles destroy every building, the electrical grid, the sewage plants, the solar panels, the water tanks, the civilian homes, the schools, the UN compounds, the bakeries, literally everything in sight, then the Western media and Western politicians talk about Israel's fierce retaliation and say nonetheless that poor Israel has the right to defend itself. During the American war in Vietnam, there was a saying for that mentality. We had to destroy the village in order to save it. Israel is just doing what needs to be done by killing all the children of the Gaza Strip. Russia is committing horrible war crimes by bombing Ukrainian electrical infrastructure. Therefore, Russia is sanctioned. The prices of food and fertilizer and other commodities skyrocket globally as a direct result of those sanctions. And Russians can't participate as Russians in sporting events. Israelis, on the other hand, can do whatever the hell they want to, and there will be no consequences. Just more arms shipments.
There are terror conflicts around this earth. It's an awful fact for what it's worth. And while we shouldn't be keeping score in Gaza, it's a slaughter, not a war. In Ukraine, fighting on the front line. A war between armies you will find. While in Gaza, tanks gunning down families, imposing famine and disease. So if you're going to Ben Russia, then surely you should Ben Israel too. The fact that this hasn't happened yet is as hypocritical as it can get. The double standard stares us in the face, asking how can you exist in such a place? To which we just say, I just don't know. Is there somewhere sane that we can go, where state is run by people who see this is no way to run a country? Cause if you're going to ban Russia, then surely you Israel too. I keep asking myself, like all my friends, is this where the whole farce ends? The most preposterous notion that anyone thought that Western civilization had moved past the times when we turned a blind eye, that we said never again to genocide, that the rule of law was sacrosanct. Take that sack of shit to the bank, eh, if you're going to ban Russia, then surely you Israel too.
So a regular speaker on this show is Whipman to Shape Wes White, as I call the Salinas Homeless Alliance activist, who has been organizing over there, or struggling to anyway, for the last decade. I recently ran into an item of his on the Facebook page, which I'm going to play the audio of. It's titled Apparent Voter Intimidation by DA Office Monterey County with Signers of Protect Salinas Renters. Now, I know homeless folks, the main topic of this show, are not renters, usually. They'd like to be, but they're not. But this affects, of course, homeless folks, because the more renters that get shafted, the more homeless folks there are, and the more difficulties for everyone. So let's hear a little bit about this, and I'm going to try to get in touch with Wes White and see if he wants to give me an update, though he can be hard to reach.
Good afternoon, Chair Lopez and Board of Supervisors. My name is Chris Barrera, President of LULAC Council 2055. I am here today because our communities have been wronged. The District Attorney's investigation into the Protect Salinas Renters petition did not protect the public.
And this is a speech to the County Board of Supervisors in Monterey, the county directly to our south, which of course also includes Salinas.
It intimidated the public. Food was not given out in exchange for signatures. There was no wrongdoing, and the DA ultimately confirmed that. Yet despite that, armed investigators wearing guns and badges went door to door to the homes of working families, renters, seniors, and many immigrant residents, questioning them simply because they signed a legal petition. Let's be honest. When armed agents knock on your door asking about your political activity, that is not civic outreach. It's intimidation. For many families in our Latino and immigrant communities, law enforcement presence at their door creates fear, especially when they have done nothing wrong. The chilling message sent was clear. Participate in democracy and you may be targeted. That is a form of voter suppression, plain and simple. This investigation also represents a waste of taxpayer money and a misplacement of priorities. At a time when our county faces serious public safety challenges, scarce law enforcement resources were used to investigate community members for exercising their constitutional rights. Those resources should be protecting our community, not frightening it. LULAC strongly believes that democracy depends on trust. And trust is broken when government uses intimidation tactics against the people it serves. We call on the district attorney to acknowledge the harm caused, commit publicly to stopping these practices, and establish clear guidelines that prevent future investigations from targeting petition signers or voters who have committed no crimes. Democracy should never come with a knock on your door by armed officials. Our families deserve protection, dignity, and respect.
Thank you,
not
Mr. Burr.
Hear from using
we're,
their voices.
We're time.
And thank you.
Good morning. Name is Eric Peterson. Sorry, I'm a little out of practice. I would just like to agree wholeheartedly with what Chris said. I used to be was essentially a civil investigator for the federal government, unarmed. No uniform or anything like that. And I know I scared people. I tried not to, but people get nervous when somebody comes knocking on their door and starts asking questions. And our community doesn't need that. We've got limited resources, and we need to put them towards more important things than trying to intimidate the public. Thank you.
All right, we're going to go to Christian Schneider next. Mr. Schneider?
Boy, I had something I wanted to talk about, but then I saw Mr. Barrera speak, and it's something that's a little bit near and dear to me, having cops interfere with elections or electoral duties. Now, Mr. Barrera is correct. That is intimidation. Not only that, but how much money did you spend on investigating this? These are serious, serious questions. Now, the problem that you have in your county is who do you report this to? Well, I can answer that because I actually understand how your government works. It's your county council. Your county council is the electoral official for investigations. They can then refer it to somebody else. Yeah, see, you knew this was coming, didn't you, Ms. Blitch? And that's been a major, major problem because Ms. Blitch has been exerting triple influence, meaning that you're supposed to, she was the attorney for you guys misspending over $150,000 on electoral issues, mainly a political partisan campaign. But you're all, that's also the reporting agency. So when I sent you that letter back saying, hey, look, I've been threatened during a lawsuit. I've been threatened to drop a recall campaign. And I reported it to Ms. Blitch. You see, I was following the law with the expectation that you also would follow the law. So, Ms. Blitch, what happened to that report? And I only ask because it's my constitutional right.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider.
So on the line with me is Wes White, who's a Salinas homeless activist who is also covering a lot of other things. He's a video journalist who regularly posts on John Doe 13K, and he recently went to a, I guess it's a Salinas Monterey County City Council, Salinas City Council meeting, looks like. And there was also a, he covered something from the, I guess it was the Board of Supervisors. The first thing, and I played these two clips, or actually I played one clip, the clip of the actual, the business of the council.
The voter intimidation?
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly what the words I was looking for. Tell me a little bit about that. What was that guy talking about anyway? Tell me.
So on Tuesday, yeah, there was a Board of Supervisors meeting. Chris Barrera, who's the president of LULAC Council 2055 in Salinas, he is...
What is LULAC? I'm sorry. Tell me what LULAC is. Most of us don't know.
Oh, LULAC is the League of United Latin American Citizens.
Go for
started
it.
In like the 20s.
Uh-huh.
So they're a civil rights organization, you know, worried about discrimination and parity and pay, equity, things of that. So the Fraud Five, as I would call them, the Taylor Fraud Five, the big corporate interests, the villains that Steinbeck wrote about, who are mainly owned and operated by the property managers and the ag industry, you know, two biggest pieces of this economy here. they voted to repeal rent stabilization, rental registry, tenant anti-harassment, and unjust evictions. Four different ordinances that were put into place in August of 2024 and immediately repealed upon sitting as soon as they could, which came around to May. And in May, they just said they were going to repeal it and they don't care what anybody says. And so a bunch of folks said, well, yeah, right. And they started Protect Salinas Renters. And within 30 days, they were able to gather over 10,000 signatures.
They being the people who wanted to keep the ordinances in place that protect the renters, or the other group?
Yes.
Which one?
We call ourselves Protect Salinas Renters. There's over 200 volunteers that gathered 10,000 signatures within 30 days. You know, quite a few professionals, quite a few just, you know, folks that don't want to become homeless, you know? So they were able to gather a lot of signatures to block the repeal. It was a referendum that was certified, you know, the beginning of July, and it made it with just a little over 7,000 signatures, which was the mark. So barring for errors and omissions, out of district, you know, not complete signature blocks, you know, they couldn't be validly counted. But they knew that, and that's why they worried about a cushion, and they still made the ballot.
Let me clarify. You know, this, Wes. What this means is, I know we've tried to get initiatives in our county too, and I think I've even been familiar with the process of trying to overturn a city council action by referendum, which can be done too, but it has to be done within 30 days. Pretty horrendous deadline.
That is what we accomplished.
And so what you usually got to get is got a 10% or 15% of the voters at the last election, registered
right.
voters who are and often, you know, that can involve a lot of people who think they live in the city, but they don't. They live right outside the city, or they moved. or in other words, just simple human error requires, as you say, a cushion. But you were able to get all this. Was it a very expensive activity, or was it mostly human labor?
Well, it was certainly expensive. I think over $30,000 might have been invested into the effort. So one of the things that they were doing to attract people was to offer some free food. And the way, you know, it wasn't a prerequisite to be able to get food that you had to sign a petition. That was just to attract you to come over and hopefully get you to sign, but it was not a requirement. And that was the allegation, that people were bribing to get a signature out of them.
Is there any law that prohibits, serving food while gathering signatures or something?
No, only if you're going to use it as a quid pro quo.
And did they present any evidence that the quid pro quo was being done?
Absolutely not.
What happened? What was the outcome of this? West. All right, so we got you back again. So we lost you there for a minute. So the question I had for you a moment ago was, I guess a question before that is, who was contributing most of the money for this? Were they large organizations? Minor donations, small donations from individuals?
It's going to be more or less individuals because, business owners, I suppose, because organizations could only support. I don't think the organizations put any money into the referendum.
Okay, but
there was a organization formed, and I don't know what number it goes with or whatever, but they are a legal entity called Protect Salinas Renters, and you could probably investigate them that way.
And now, and again, before we go further, can you again go through each of these laws and what are the laws that were passed and then overturned by the city council that this referendum was trying to get the laws back again?
Okay, so first it started out with a rental registry, which is basically any home that was being rented and is before 1995 built, and the landowner has at least three or four, I think, at least four properties that they're renting, then they are required to register with the city saying, this is my house and I charge this much, for a 3-2 or whatever, right? And that registry didn't even get 35% filled. So then there was a fee associated with it as well, which of course was the first complaint. And then in August we had tenant protection, which is more like anti-harassment, I'm not sure how to really expound on that too much, but basically bullying for your rent without even, giving you full value for your property. Like threatening to try to evict you for this reason or that reason, especially if it's not legal. They also had unjust evictions. So if they did kick out a person within, say they've been there over a year or whatever, then there's extra protections for if you have to get evicted and they have to pay another like three times the rent for someone to move out, and then the person that moves in there, if you say it's for your family member's got to stay there for like 5 years, and if they don't, then you have to notify them that the place is available again. And for a large part, a lot of frustration on the owners, worrying about how much money is going out and they can't even get their family to be able to be there. And then of course the other reason is the rent evictions, which is a likely scenario where you get kicked out and then they just raise the rent. And so that was kind of a precursor against that, because a lot of places were going from like $3,000 to $4,000 just 1 month later as soon as you got a new lease.
Were these laws effective? In other words, did the landlords follow the laws while they were there?
Those laws could have been effective, but the Fraud Five put a kibosh on it to begin with, telling all the property managers, don't worry about it, don't pay it, we're going to kill it. Mm-hmm. And majority, I mean, they got the majority, and if it wasn't for the community coming together and gathering those 10,000 signatures within 30 days, you know, it just would have been a slam dunk.
What was the majority on the city council or the board of supervisors that did this, that originally overturned the law?
Now the supervisors have their own little, and it's not even really the supervisors, the DA's office doing their own thing because Pacioni is elected.
But in terms of the laws, the ones that were passed, what was the vote that passed the laws?
Oh, it was unanimous in the 2024. Even McShane and the mayor both said yes to it. Nobody was in opposition.
And what was the vote?
What do you call that? Unity.
What was the vote to turn it around?
6-1, maybe 5-2.
And was it because there was a different people have been elected to office? What was the reason for that?
Yeah, the Fraud Five took over. Yeah.
And those are what, new people who came in?
Yeah, 1.6 million between five of them.
Meaning what? So what does that mean?
Meaning collectively through their campaign, during the campaign, you know, from August or even before that until November 24, they amassed 1.6 million between five of them.
And this was the campaign to elect these particular people?
Yeah, they had a whole running slate. There was a guy, Steve McShane, who was basically one of the most dastardly, cartoonishly villainous characters of corruption. He was a city slicker salesman, snake oil salesman. Really good. It goes down smooth, and he had the smile. You know, really hard to beat, especially because he's bilingual. But he's always business top heavy, and I would imagine he's the king of NDAs in this area. And especially another contract. There's always another contract in it for him.
So Wes, these five were able to reverse the laws you've described, but then the referendum was the petitioners were able to gather enough signatures to put that on the ballot, and then what happened?
Well, no, what they did was they blocked the repeal. And for blocking the repeal, the city had a choice to either let it stand and don't worry about it anymore, take it back and pick it apart some more, or put it up for a vote. The attorney made it pretty clear that, yeah, you could fuck with it, but it's going to make you look bad. So that's when they're like, okay, I guess we better put it to a vote. Let's put it to a vote now. Let's spend all of our money now on a special election this November. That was in May. And July to August, which, you know, it's just way too short a time span to begin with. Plus, the frivolousness of spending money when they really pride themselves on conservative value, not spending money. Which obvious clear-cut lie for their own biases and interests, and they settled on having it next November 2026.
So at the current time, is the law in effect or is the repeal?
It is in effect until then. So, but this whole last year, because they told all the owners, don't pay it because we're going to kill it, and so they created mass confusion on purpose. And resistance, to follow the law, the law and order crowd, telling their buddies, don't worry about it, we ain't coming after you. In fact, we'll try to kill the law, so then that way you don't have nothing to worry about.
So have the laws, these are four laws we're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Are these four laws still being enforced by anybody either?
They were not enforced, and you better believe the administration is going to drag their ugly feet trying not to do it.
So do the citizens have any way of attempting to activate these laws?
Well, we certainly do show up.
Well, you may talk about it at public comment, but can you do anything like file lawsuits to get the laws enforced?
They tell you that they're going to enforce them.
Well, no, but what you do is you present evidence they're not enforcing them, and you try to get a writ of mandate from a court requiring them to enforce them.
Right. Well, this whole year would be a perfect opportunity, right? I mean, because it certainly begs the question, how'd you only end up with 35%, you know?
I don't understand the phrase. What's the 35%? What are you speaking
of? So they only got 35% compliance between all the property managers and owners in the city who have buildings that are, you know, under 95.
Is there any penalty for those who do not properly file?
There you go again. Well, why would we want to hurt our friends?
I'm asking, does the...
Excuse me, Wes. Because of too much confusion.
Wes, is there a penalty mentioned in the law, is my question.
That is a good question. I am uncertain at the moment.
Because, you know, clearly it's obvious. It's obvious corrupt officials or pals of landlords are going to try to avoid this. The problem they're going to have is if there's some specific penalties provided.
Right. Well, they're getting a refund right now because apparently they were overcharged and no staff did anything because they were not directed to do anything all year, like, you know, listen to complaints. In fact, they would tell the renters, oh, just go ahead and pay it. We don't know what's going to happen. Just go ahead and pay it.
And is the group that actually pushed the referendum successfully still in being?
That's a tougher one because some people wanted to let out after the referendum. They really don't want to go after the election drive for this whole year. So we're reorganizing structure a little bit.
And we'll get back to Wes probably in just a bit after a little musical break here. Instead of actually playing more of the Gaza guided tour, we're going to turn to another download by Rovix and Tsuno called Rage Bait, a guided tour, because I think I played some of the Gaza stuff at the last couple of shows. This is, it mentions Gaza as well, of course, because Gaza is, I think, uppermost in a lot of our minds, mine included. Well, not enough of the time. I occasionally come back to it, and most of the time it's nowhere near my mind, unfortunately, because I'm afraid that the ongoing visual genocide has all kinds of coarsening and dehumanizing effects, not just on the Gazans, not just on the Israelis, but on all of us. So it's important that we keep trying to find ways to face it, and that's the whole purpose of playing some of this stuff on the show.
Hello, fellow Earthlings. This is Aitsuno. My pronouns are either she or they, depending on whether we're talking about the singer of the band or the band. We could have clarified that from the beginning by calling this musical project the Aitsuno Band instead of Aitsuno, but we didn't do that, and now we're 8 albums in, so it might be a bit late to change the name. On the other hand, we have almost zero audience on any platform so far, so it probably doesn't matter what we do with regards to such considerations. I'm here to share our new album, Rage Bait. Rage Bait is our 8th album as Aitsuno. That is to say, this is the 8th album that has involved David Rovix as a lyricist, prompt engineer, and producer, in collaboration with his AI band. If we count these albums as David Rovix albums, then this is David's 58th album. As far as YouTube music is concerned, however, this would be David's 8th album. The other 50 were entirely deleted in late November 2025 by YouTube with a no notification or explanation. Aitsuno albums might be next, who knows, so listen to them while you can. One more thing before I get into telling you about this album. If you want to know more about David's Aitsuno musical project, if you go to davidrovix.com, you'll find an Aitsuno section with lots more about David's process of working with his AI band to get the songs into the shape they ultimately take. In a nutshell, he says that, aside from the state of AI music generation having become a wildly impressive thing, what's really essential are the right combination of strange and contradictory prompts, getting the lyrics to scan optimally, and knowing when you've got what you're looking for, which for David isn't usually to be found within the first 30 or 40 takes, but sometime after that. Okay, now on to Rage Bait. What the 10 songs on the album have in common is they were all written and recorded during the last half of November 2025, and like all of Aitsuno's material, post the first 3 albums, it's mostly what they'd call political in nature. The first song, Little Orange Toys, was inspired by a report on the news from an NGO that estimated there was a child somewhere in the Gaza Strip being killed or maimed by a shiny little piece of unexploded ordnance on average once per hour. One of the main manufacturers of the cluster bombs that are designed to leave behind shiny orange toys for children to play with before they explode is the U.S. company Lockheed Martin.
After over 2 years of a total war, there's nothing left standing of those cities by the shore, which they once called Gaza, part of ancient Palestine. Now just miles of rubble divided by a yellow line. There are no playgrounds left, all of them destroyed by explosives or bulldozers systematically deployed, which destroyed the schools with all the carnage bombs will bring, leaving behind ruins scattered with colorful things. And the children left alive, the little girls and little boys are playing with the little with no schools and no food and 8 children in a tent. An impossible scenario for any human parent. And somewhere in the Gaza Strip, every hour of each day, another child killed or maimed who just wanted to play. Designed not to explode, colorful shiny objects that lie beside the road, banned by so many nations but not by the Zionists. So Lockheed Martin sells them dim to help them fight the terrorists. And the children left alive, the little girls and little boys are playing with the little orange toys. And the children left alive, the little girls and little boys are playing with the little orange toys.
I know Gilroy's doing one pit stop outreach, and I don't know what I think that's probably what Jan Berenstein Chargan would probably be under.
Let me interrupt that. You for just a moment, because as usual I've had a little equipment problem. But what you're talking about, Wes, is no, don't laugh too loudly. I'll get embarrassed. is the memorials that happen every year in cities, kind of commemorating all the corpses, the homeless corpses, and there's one.
They lament, but they don't block. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, Santa Cruz will be having one, I think, an official one, you know, which is funded by the poverty pimps of Funding Matters. I'm pretty sure that's.
Oh, I heard they're going defunct by March.
Well, no, they're building more buildings. They're just cutting off services to anyone who isn't on their a pseudo pathway to housing, you see. So, it's pretty heavy, and the city council and the board of supervisors has done nothing about that other than say that we're going to meet and talk about it, and then we'll present some kind of proposals before on or before February 28th. But since the cutoff of funding for showers, mail, respite areas, water spigots is all going to be happening on March 1st, unless, as I understand, there's been some rumors it's been delayed, but I haven't gotten any solid information on that. It doesn't mean that there's anything that's going to be in place, along with, of course, the end of MH Can here, the end of the downtown street team, and, of course, the continuing pretty much full-up Tier 3 RV program, which is at the Armory, which maybe there's some movement on it, but I haven't seen any reports about it or heard anything that there's been any massive or meaningful expansion of it or even shift in the people that are there. So what I always do when I go to these memorials is I say, you know, the people who are, the memorials don't mean much except to the people who actually knew folks who died. That's the one thing. And the second thing is it's meaningless if you're going to be supporting the same institutional structures that presided over the conditions that created this, these deaths.
Yeah, what are you going to do different? Nothing? Well, then what are we crying about?
Well, it's more like what are we going to do different to stop that from happening? Because they aren't going to do shit. I mean, that's the problem.
Right. No, I know it. Well, I'm hoping you just got my 10-year anniversary flyer thing. So, I'm hoping to get a really large turnout of vendors, I guess. But, no, it's 100 local organizations, mainly nonprofits, but they're not sellouts.
Okay, so what's your, and now I got your email, and I'm looking at it. It's the new group you formed called HUGS, H-U-G-S, which is an acronym for Helping You Get Support. It's a brand new nonprofit, which you are the executive director, but of course, I won't. You're not going to cut anything off the top on that one, I'm sure. I am sure, because I know you, but there's a meeting coming up for a 10-year anniversary celebration of the Now You See It, Now You Don't, maybe probably see more of it in your neck of the woods than in mine, the Salinas Monterey County Homeless Union. It's going to be at the National John Steinbeck Center on Salinas. I'm reading from your email. On January 17th, 2026, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and you're going to be inviting potentates from the National Union of the Homeless, including a Dr. Liz Thea Harris, who's the co-chair of the Have They Done Anything Recently Poor People's Campaign. They probably have, but I remember that's one of the reasons I had so little confidence in Drew Glover when he was doing this Poor People's Campaign here, a call for moral revival, and that they weren't taking on any of the issues that had to do with the specifics in this locality. And Drew did take on some of those issues and, of course, got recalled for it. But nonetheless, I am suspicious of these kinds of organizations, but you have had perhaps better experience than I have and have more hopeful views. Anything else you want to say about this upcoming January 17th event, which people listening to my program, some of them might be interested.
Well, you know, Huff has been invited as well.
Well, we'll probably come, you know.
Really what we're trying to do is get at a serious conversation and get at the real root of solution right here, right? Because we already know what it is. It's just a matter of other people stopping the administrations from doing it. And that's where the rub is. I mean, we there's solidarity, there's strength in numbers. And I'm hoping that everybody who's tabling for all these silos of issues and topics that only they care about, you know, but I know them all, you know, because I've been supporting them all. And it's amazing how many people don't know each other. They don't have the time. Who has who has the capacity to really worry about more than one issue? An awful lot of them don't. And what they do is actually pretty intense. So, you know, I can't really knock them to some degree, but to another degree, I can.
Now, what are some of those issues, Wes, that are unfortunately being pursued very much in isolation, as if I understand what you're saying correctly, and not with connections to the rest of the deeper movement? Give me an example of some of those organizations.
Okay, I'll start going through the A's here that are not homeless related. Alliance of Monterey Area Preservationists, and they work a lot on historical buildings. Alma Listen Tribal Band, ACLU, Monterey County, Artists Inc., Asian Cultural Experience, Barrios Unidos, Big Sur Land Trust, Black Monterey County, Black Lives Matter Seaside, California Families Rise, which is against CPS corruption, CSUMB faculty, I guess I'm going to try to get in on. I've supported them. Campaign for Regenerative Agriculture, which is out of Watsonville. Center for Farmworker Families in Cora. That's the same Cora. Central Coast DSA, Citizens for Just Water, COPA, you know, I don't know, that's an outlier. Cultural Relevance and Humility Committee, which I tried to hit up. I've got Enchantrix, which is a theater group. Everyone's Harvest, which is, you know, they do organic food. I got Food Not Bombs on the list. Fort Ord Environmental Justice Network. Future Leaders of Change. I got a George Floyd Reimagining Policing. Hopefulness, maybe. I've got H-Peace, I've got the Japanese American Citizens League, I've got Queens Council, Escuelita or BHC, Thriving Communities, Land Watch, League of Women Voters, LULAC twice, Greenfield and Salinas, MILPA, Manjushri Dharma Center, which I might, they may come.
Now, when you get to some of these that are a little more obscure, don't just give me the acronym. Give me the, if you have it, the full, what the acronym stands for.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good one. MILPA is Motivating Individuals and Leadership. I don't know the other ones. I got Monterey County Black Caucus, Monterey County Historical Society. I mean, these are all organizations that I've supported, and they are not like mainstream. Monterey County Renters United, Monterey Peninsula Pride, Monterey Waterkeeper, Naha Mauna, NAACP Monterey County Branch, National Association Americans Colored People, something like that. NCBI, which is National Coalition Building Institute, National Coalition on Homelessness, National Nurses United, Never Again Moss Landing, New Arrivals Car Club, Noche Bohemia, Nonprofit Alliance of Monterey County, Ohlone, Costa Noan, Esalen Nation, OSIN, Pacific Grove Progressives, Palenque Arts, Pajaro Rising, Pause the Calls, People's Oral History Project, Pit Stop Outreach, Poor People's Campaign California, PDA MAC, which is Progressive Democrats of America, Monterey Area Chapter, Protect Monterey County, Protect Salinas Renters, Public Water Now, Kwok Moy Foundation, they do the Walk of Remembrance, Radio Bilingue, Radio Vision, Resource Center for Nonviolence, Robert Norse, also aka, what the hell is your group again?
Huff, Homeless United. You forgot the most important group. You're going to get it, man.
Yeah, so Huff is Housing United for Friendship and Freedom. Close?
Homeless United for Homeless. Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay, well, I didn't write you out. Sorry. The Romero Institute, Safe Ag, Safe Schools, Salinas Interfaith Leaders, Salinas Juneteenth, Salinas Palestine Solidarity, Salinas Valley Pride, Salinas Valley Rapid Response, Santa Cruz for Bernie, Sean Doherty for Congress, SEIU 521 in Salinas, Sharebred, Shinsho Mugindaiko Drumming, Somos Watsonville, Sunrise Movement Salinas, the Beatitudes Center for the Nonviolent Jesus, the Village Project, Transformative Justice Center, UFW, United Farm Workers Foundation, UNAM, which is United Nations Association in Monterey Bay, United Way Monterey County, Veterans for Peace, Western Regional Advocacy Project, Wise for Racial Equity, WILF, which is
Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
Thank you.
A largely defunct group here, but maybe you got more of them there.
Yeah, well, they actually put on one event a year, which is the Hiroshima Nagasaki Day Remembrance.
Is that concluded, or is there more?
No, that's pretty well the alphabet right there.
Okay, well,
that's like 105 different, ones.
So what I'm probably going to do is I'm going to take that list. I don't know if anybody will continue listening to this netcast if they have to listen to that entirely long list. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to essentially excise the list but keep it, because I think it's important. I guess the suggestion I'd have is what you want to do is get all these people working along, and of course this is my focus, on civil rights issues and service issues for homeless people and people outside, and for renters for that matter, in a very sort of pared down, bone and gristle kind of way, in the sense that you have four or five different things they all agree on. And then you have certain things that can be done around those issues. And you see if anybody wants to agree to do them, because that's the problem. We always get lots of people at the Huff meetings are always talking about doing this and that, but people don't have the time, the energy, the resources, or the motivation fails, or the health fails, that sort of thing. But if you have, it's possible if you can unite around certain basic, not just principles, but really demands is what you got to put it at. Put it as demands and see if anybody, if you can get 10% of those organizations to support the demands and do something around them, you got something going. But what I've always told you is I don't think it has anything to do with the 10th anniversary meeting, but it has to do with the kind of work you've done all through the year. But maybe, you can do both. I mean, I'm hoping that, you can effectively do both. So.
Right. Well, and for me, I guess I've been on a trip of thinking about, paying it forward. Okay, well, fine. I've been paying it forward 10 years. How about four-star paying it back? And, I'm hoping that I've proven whatever, that I really care about people. It's not, I'm not here for a grift. We're just here to do the right thing and maybe get some money out of it, to survive. It's not a greed thing.
I've
been basically taken care of this whole time anyway, so.
Gotcha. Well, I will leave the survival mechanism that you're seeking to put together, which I think is, perfectly understandable and right, and hopefully it will also have positive consequences in addition to above and beyond.
Tell me what you think of this thing, because one of the major driving forces I'm hoping for is to motivate the folks that live right across the street from the Steinbeck Center to stick and stay, and like be on public property and demand some space, what are you doing wrong? If it's not a health and safety risk, then the only thing you're doing is simple trespass.
I'm not sure what you're talking about, Wes. You got to be clearer. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, some stick and stay, establish encampments, instead of running away. One of the things that really started off with the Sherwood Park Salinas Homeless Union was that, people were being harassed and told you can't be here. And, even when they didn't even have a backpack with them, it was just their person. No alcohol, nothing, just kicking it on the bench, and they were threatened with arrest, and so one dude's just like, well, fine then, fucking arrest me, and it didn't happen, and ever after that, well, then, we can stay at the park, fuck you, and that's what was cool, and that's really the gumption, I suppose. But then we also need community support on top of that, especially now, no Martin versus Boise or anything like that. No legal protections, but certainly reasonable protections. And the more people that get hip to wanting to worry about that, people they don't know, people that they generally wouldn't care about, other than, to meet these people in person. And for these people to tell a story, too, because that's what's going to happen in the afternoon. They're going to get a good half hour. to say their piece and what they need from community, and hopefully looking them in the eye, you know, somebody will adopt a friend. You know, I mean, come on, it's about time. It's way past due. What's your New Year's resolution going
to
be this year?
See, it has to be more than a personal interest in a particular individual. Adopting a friend.
It'll be an encampment. SB 634 opens up to allow for aiding and abetting. You know, is how it was initially passed off on Fremont City Council, and they put a clause in there for aiding and abetting. If you give contraband, because it's all illegal, don't give them a tent, don't give them food, don't give them.
I know, but that provision was removed, and it made no difference according to the wisdom of. Of the attorney who fought it, you know, our friend, who and he was quite right. It's not about getting rid of a small provision in the law. It's about essentially demanding a kind of decriminalization that is real, and that you'll essentially work on in each city specifically, and not just verbally. And that does involve things like, as you say, sticking. And it, of course, it involves people who are housed coming down and sticking too. See, they don't have the protection. They don't have the protection of a necessity defense, and people who are, you know, of darker skin hue, do not have the protection of white skin, for that matter. I mean, that's always a problem. But the issue is if the conscience resonates strongly enough, then it has an effect. But I don't know. Let me get back to what I called you about, which was not
sure.
We put through a lengthy ad for your 10-year anniversary.
Right. Well, I'm not aware of a memoriam or anything like that.
I don't give a shit about that. I mean, I told you what I think about that. I think if you're going to have a memorial, it's got to be, probably should be whenever the person dies, you march to City Hall with their corpse. You know, when the person dies, I mean, that's what you do for a real memorial. I imagine they did that. They did that in Rome for people. I don't know if they did that in Rome, but I like to think they might have. In any case, what's going on that's new, or different around issues of. Are folks, I mean, you're the kind of the link in the homeless union throughout the state. What new is happening, if anything? What do you hear from different places?
There is a place in Freedom that's on a private property, and the city of Watsonville is trying to litigate to get them out. I don't know if there was a hearing or if it was postponed. I can't remember. But, you know, they're looking at needing, you know, legal observation as well, you know, just in case. And I don't know. I mean, that one concerns me. I got some friends in Pajaro and Watsonville, and out of Santa Cruz too. It's, you know, out of Pajaro Rising, they support a lot of folks that are in the river, and then I turn them onto that one. You know, because there's a good little set of folks out there in Freedom.
Where is is the encampment visitable by people who want to come and talk to folks or provide supplies for folks or just?
You have to go through Palmer Rising for that one. I am unaware of where it is.
And who in Palmer Rising, if you want to mention it publicly, is to be approached?
Well, you can message them on Instagram. They do prefer to be anonymous. It's also on the Watsonville City Council, because it's a hearing. So that would have the property on it.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
The address.
Oh, really? Well, if it has there, then if there's an address for them, do you know it?
No, I do not.
I see. Okay. Anything happening in Monterey County, I don't know, south of Watsonville that I know you...
I've been following this one from the supervisor's office because of Railroad Avenue. So Railroad Avenue, there's actually a overnight shelter there, a teen challenge program and an overnight shelter. Okay, so there's a lot of adults, mainly men, that, you know, go to that thing overnight. A lot of people go to work during the day, so they park their car on Railroad Avenue at night. It's right next to the train tracks, so it's very south of Pajaro Town community, and even distant, like, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of an industrial area. So, I mean, you know, they're far away from the community. There are a few people who live on Railroad Avenue. The executive director of that overnight shelter and teen challenge mission place, she made some statements that are, when I looked it up with the sheriff's department and the environmental health and dispatch, I'm getting records from all of them. I've gotten 2 out of 3 so far. And she made statements that she's made hundreds of calls this year. So I asked for records for the last 2 years. And aggregately, for the whole of Pajaro, you know, is averaging 4 calls total in the month. And some with 0.
I don't really understand what you're talking about, Wes, for some reason.
Oh, okay, yeah, I guess I'm taking too long to get to the point. But they want to get rid of everybody. Her and the farmer gal that, you know, owns the property next door. And they made up a bunch of bullshit to get it on the agenda. They told the supervisor, and he's like, didn't take any of their fucking shit serious. Go route it out, double check to make sure what they're saying is accurate. Just, you know, put a tow-away zone along all of Railroad Avenue, which is going to knock out a good, you know, 40, 50 parking spots, at least, you know? And so where are people supposed to go? Well, we also need to worry about putting no tow-away zone on all these other streets, too. And that's our solution again. You know, they get poised with, there's a bunch of people parking on Railroad Avenue. Why? Because you got an overnight shelter.
Yeah,
right
so
here.
Wes, I understand your outrage. Now the question is, have you been down there to organize the people who might resist this? That's the point. Has anybody been doing that? Because, I mean, you can't. You have too much to do. But is there anybody interested in doing that? That's the issue. Not is it a horrible thing? And, you know, how can we all shout about it? But we will, and I do, and you do too, and we should. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, you know,
that it's nobody else's problem. You know, like Salinas.
Well,
it's a
it's a common problem because it's happening everywhere. That's the point. And because it's a common problem, if you can agree that you help each other in different places where it's not immediately happening to you, that's what the homeless union was all about, right? That's what that was supposed to be about.
If somebody can get some stability in their life, they'd be a lot more interested in.
No, I hear that. That's for sure. Let me ask you more about. So you've given me one instance of what's happening in, you know, in Pajaro at the Railroad Avenue attempt to eliminate. Wait a minute. What community? What community are we talking about here? I'm still. You go so fast, Wes. I'm missing it. So, where is this Railroad Avenue? Is it in Salinas? Is it in Pajaro? Is it in Watsonville? And Pajaro is where?
Right south of Watsonville, the other side of the river.
Okay. All right. So, and has anybody made any efforts to organize a chapter of the union there? Or any kind of organization?
We did, but a lot of those folks got housed. So
Don't. And
goes back to Pajaro Rising that way.
Have anyone? And there's another issue about people following up on people who get housed, because, you know, you don't expect people who've been housed to spend a lot more time, but they probably have some memory of what it's all about, and because they do that, they can be relied upon in some way. For at least a sort of an echo of what went down and a sympathy for what may be coming up next for people who are still out there. At least that would be my hope. At least I.
Yeah. Well, and then Monica will come back. You know, she's going to Cabrillo. You know, she's being able to see her family. I mean, you know, I don't blame anybody for not coming back.
You're talking about Monica Tone. All right, so any other places that things are happening? What's happening in Monterey, Carmel, Pacific Grove, Gilroy, Hollister, you know, places like that?
Oh, I may have reported on this earlier in the year, but like in January, both in Monterey and Seaside, they really did an uptick on enforcement. And Monterey, they won't let you have a tent anymore, and they will tow your vehicle if they find you sleeping in it. And in Seaside, if you're homeless, you gotta get to Sand City during the day, and they don't want to see you at all. They, you know, and you better move all your stuff because we're gonna take whatever's left.
Is this the unspoken policy of the police department, or has it been put into law in some way?
No, not in policy. It's a speakeasy, absolutely.
So this is in Seaside. It's get to Sand City or get out, or we take your vehicle.
Yes, it's a sun up town.
Now, how much of this is actually happened, or how much of this is one or two instances?
Oh no, it's been ongoing. It's become the policy. Seaside says you got to go to Sand City during the day. Sand City says you better not be here by nightfall. So.
And again, I ask you, how many instances have you heard of this?
I suppose I've seen it since the beginning of the year. I haven't tracked it as well since about May.
Okay, it's quite reasonable to say, okay, I walked into the police department and said, my three friends here need to know if they can sleep in vehicles here. Are you telling us that we can't do that? And did you get the name? Did you get the? Did you get the name of the officer who told you that? In other words, I'm looking to get to set up a paper trail for what is clearly, ultimately, a violation of a constitutional right. It clearly is.
Yeah.
They're not engaging in criminal behavior when they sleep in their vehicle, and particularly if there's no law that says they can't. And if there is a law, they have to show that it's not creating a greater necessity, as you know, was pointed out in, I guess, in the Vallejo case. That's the latest kind of hope for people who have watched Martin versus Boise disappear into the sea. The Vallejo case, which is that you show that there's a greater danger to move people, and it's a state-created danger, I guess, is the proper phrase.
Yes. Yeah, the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, and that was successfully used in various injunctions, you know, by our friend up in Marin County.
Yeah, no, Robbie and Jason have been really
Robbie Powelson and Jason. And Jason, what's the last name?
Sarah.
Say it again. Sarah's?
Yes.
Hmm.
S-A-R-R-I-S.
Thank you. That makes it easier. I was thinking of S-E-R-E-S.
Yeah, he ran for supervisor in Marin County. And was able to get some policies over the line that way, too, because the other candidates also echoed him.
Excellent. No, that's good. Do you know more about that?
Not terribly. I mean, this is part of it, too. I mean, you can be there to cackle and fill in, ask dangerous questions, you know, and put them on the spot. And who knows? Maybe you might be impressed. Or maybe you might be more in a professor mood, you know.
Any word from Southern California?
Peggy said she's going to come with her dog as long as she can bring her dog.
Peggy Lee Kennedy of the Venice Justice Committee.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And San Diego is asking to start a homeless union. And, I mean, the other one that's kind of southward is Fresno. And Dez is coming. Dez is always kicking ass, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a beginning. I would, I think I'm going to leave it there for the time being. Is there anything you need to know from me? Not that I can necessarily tell you anything. It sounds like you're more connected than I am, but for sure.
Well, you should try hit up them folks out in Freedom. Shouldn't be too hard to find. I can send you, I'll forward you something on it, and I'll ask them, you know, I'll give them your number and see if maybe they'll call you. You know, just another outlet to explain and complain, you know?
Explain and complain, right on. Now, that's our middle name. So, I thank you, man. I'm going to try to wind this down so I can get to bed.
Good idea. Well, I mean, you only got 2 hours of content tomorrow, right? Or three instead of the five?
So. Something like that.
Sounds fun.
All right,
man. That's a lot of work, dude. You're dedicated. I really appreciate that.
You're doing a lot of work yourself. I think you do more than I do, but then again, you're...
You more, do different work.
You do different work of different kinds. Anyway, let's...
I'm not very consistent.
Yeah, so you gotta do what you gotta do. We each follow our way. I'll talk to you again.
Midnight. All right, keep agitating.
You too. Bye bye.
One of the things that tends to get lost with reporting in the Western media related to Palestine is if they report on it at all, the focus will be on the Gaza Strip, where they'll talk about Israel's fierce retaliation to the Hamas attacks in southern Israel on October 7th, 2023. It's not a genocidal war on all the people of Gaza. So goes the Western media narrative. It's a war between Hamas and Israel. However, they frame the war on Gaza. The war against the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank is largely invisible, but it's been happening at the level of a pogrom every day in one town, farm, village, or city in the West Bank since the October 7th uprising. Even more invisible than the carnage wrought by Israeli settlers and soldiers across the West Bank since October 2023. Though is the whole history of massacres, mass detention, home demolitions, crop burning, annexation, and displacement that have characterized life for all of the Palestinians since before Israel became a state. This has been going on in one violent form or another for over 80 years.
They had to get out of Europe and go where they could. People who would have been lost, it was understood. No one would let them in, so they came to Palestine, following the colonial plan before they drew the green line. They declared their country. As their campaign went on, they made hundreds of thousands flee to Syria and Lebanon, to Gaza and to Jordan. Then in the 67 war, when Greater Israel began, from the river to the shore, then came the settlement. From then until the present day, the annexation continued. Whatever you hear them say, reality tends to intrude, because the reality is massacres monthly, weekly, daily, such as for the last 2 years, killed off by his way. Then came the settlements and slaughter.
Okay, today is the, 13th of December. I'm down here at the town clock. Everybody's kind of getting ready to go because we're getting late. It's about 3:15. Talking with
Steve Enriquez, security for Food Not Bombs. Almost here.
And Steve, how's the day been at Food Not Bombs?
It's been pretty peaceful here. You know, we just got to watch people's stuff or have people watch their stuff so they're not stolen and all, because it's desperate times and all, and measures and all, looking for survival, you know, what's going on, homelessness and all. So they're pretty healthy here. I mean, I would say the weather has tempered them to survival, just out of necessity here. So, as far as I'm concerned, they're ready for the moon if they want to colonize it, to survive there.
So what have you heard about police sweeps, if anything? Because I know that some people have been concerned about that in the past.
I'm from Aromas, and yeah, I got my own sweep in the home, you know, but that's different. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's going on here, but I come out to see who's still standing. You know, people that I've known, been helping all along, keeping them out of the ditch and all, best I can. So, yeah, that's pretty peaceful. I haven't seen a whole lot of arrests going on, police sirens and all. So I think people have got learned how to live civil, I think, is what's going on here.
How are the numbers in the last, when did you arrive today, for example?
I arrived here about 1:30 or 2, and after I got done performing over the Crow's Nest with the Sons and Daughters of the Peach performances. So yeah, it was pretty peaceful. You know, everyone was getting food and no one was fighting. It was good.
And what have you seen in the last week? Are you mostly around Aromas, or do you ever get up here much?
I get out here because I'm doing therapy and everything for my grieving and all the stuff, my medical history and all. I keep a lot of doctors, with vacation pay.
Right.
You go in the waiting room, it's like, okay, the receptionists and the secretaries, they're on the computer looking where they're going to go next. Wait a minute. I go to the hospital for mine. It's good to look where there's good service and good food. I'm saying.
You had a kind of a call you wanted to put out. You're looking for people interested in doing free radio?
Yes. We have a tribal community here. Well, I mean, the bell ceremony and all this. Very ceremonial area here, and there's a lot of history here that Lewis and Clark didn't get. And we need to finish that up. Because, people say, it's fighting over what kind of supremacy is going on here. As far as I know, it's a red supremacy hemisphere screaming from the ground.
But those that remain, anyway.
Yes, it wasn't right how they got taken. Resources and all. Same old, same old. Still going on today. I mean,
yeah.
Worse now. But yeah. But I'm hoping, I live near where the mission was. In San Juan Bautista, where the last Powwow and Indian Market were. So, in order to get back to where the freedom we once knew, we got to pull things back together.
Now, what about anything more about free radio? Because you were talking about that.
What was that?
Well, you were saying you'd like to get involved in radio.
Yeah, when the pandemic hit, I was already doing virtual reality because I do 3D printing, so I do computer graphics. Most people breathe. Yeah, but I was born and raised in San Jose, so in the dawn of computers and all. So, but yeah, but the thing is, the radio station, I already announced it to, online with the people on, Active Worlds, which is a site that we do building of, 3D modeling and all. But I let them know that we're working on, keeping something, a good flow of information for the tribes that were once here.
Well, if you hear of anybody who's interested, get their contact information and pass it on to me, and I'll pass it on to the radio, the remains of the radio collective from Free Radio.
We got to preserve the Indian, the ways of the West here. It's wild, yeah, but the thing is that they survived. We survived. I'm Mayan myself, so it's a little different than survival for me. But yeah. They survived the elements of the Aleutian Islands, walking here from the land of the three wise men.
Many decades and millennia ago.
Yeah, from Asia. And they came walking over here from the Aleutian, through. I know a few Eskimos how they survive out there, too. It's great.
But, and we have been talking with
Steve Enriquez, Food Not Bombs.
Anything that we haven't covered, Steve, you want to talk about?
Well, years ago when we started doing music for Food Not Bombs, the lawyer mentioned to me while there's speeches going on stage and everything about uniting the homeless union. It's the largest union on the planet, and if we ever got things together with them, all of us together as one, we can do anything we set our minds to.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes, I mean, the water system, it's like torture.
Talking with, what's your name?
Zach Alvarez.
Zach, you're playing the Jackson Professional Tool Wheelbarrows.
Yes, the Jackson 3.
And they're blue, I might add.
And they're blue, yeah, they're the blue states. Oh, I want to share something with you I was thinking about just yesterday or the day before. And that is, was that yesterday? I was, somehow it got on the my mind, it's funny how it is, but it got on my mind this poem by William Carlos Williams about the Red Wheelbarrow. It's only four lines long. It's a short, much celebrated poem among American academics and scholarly people and people who appreciate poetry, and he had a special take on briefness and not a lot of complexity in poetry. And his poem is been co-opted from maybe its original meaning or meanings, and is appreciated for different reasons by different people, different readers and audiences. But I was thinking about how the MAGA people might take it because it's red. Blue is not mentioned, but blue and white are mentioned in the poetry. It talks about a red wheelbarrow, wet by rain, fresh fallen rain, and sitting alone, empty, and white chickens next to it. And so that was just an image that strikes a lot of people who are, you know, appreciate beauty and aesthetics and maybe a little bit of remorse about, is a little bit remorseful about something. And anyway, people read a lot into it, but the MAGA people will take that poem and they'll say, the water has cleaned the wheelbarrow, it's empty, it's ready to go into cultural warfare against the blue people who are bereft of these ideas that we have for the future. Anyway, red is associated with red states.
Can I get you to do a little playing of your blue percussion so we can hear what it's like?
But what do you think about that? That's kind of interesting to think about.
I've never been much of a classical poetry... What's his name again?
Like William Carlos Williams.
I've heard of him.
Either.
Yeah. There's some poets I know and some poems I appreciate, but I'm more of a prose guy myself.
Okay.
But let's... And a little bit of a radio man.
Because you're on that...
Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm not on KZSC. That's a real radio station.
KSCO?
This is... KSCO is another real, although right-wing, radio station.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, I mean, they do different things. But, yeah, they're commercial. They sell vitamins, things of that sort. But, yeah, I mean...
My old family home was on Corcoran Lagoon, on Corcoran Street. And we were the only Native Americans in Santa Cruz for many years, many, many decades.
What tribe are you with?
The Ohlones all got shipped out, you know. They all got sent to Pico Rivera and San Gabriel, Mission San Gabriel, and Santa Barbara and San Diego. So there weren't any Ohlones here for a very long time.
And you are?
But my grandmother came out here in the 20s to work in the fields in Salinas and Watsonville, Santa Cruz. She worked in the...
She was Native American?
Native American from Montana. She worked at the old Brussels sprouts plant, which is over on the west part of Santa Cruz over there. And among other things, I think she worked in the lettuce and the asparagus or whatever they call the artichokes, right? My family's been here for decades. A long time.
I want to hear this music before I walk away because I got to go.
You might even say 100 years. Okay, let's see. This is a 13-beat rhythm. Some people might say associated with Hopi rhythms. So you can't count to 13, so let's count to 6 and then count to 7. How does it sound?
Okay.
Lose count, but you can count to 6 and 7, or you can count to 7 and 6, or you can count to 8 and then count to 5. Anyway, they say something's very serious about the 13-beat rhythm. We all feel that way.
And we have been listening to the music and the commentary of
Zach Alvarez.
Zach Alvarez. Let me give you my card, and you can also hear Well, you know, you've been doing this, so you know how you sound. But in case you want to hear the how you sound on the archive, we do not have a radio station. We have a place on the net, and we have a 30-year history of archiving stuff. We did have a radio station for 25 of those years. Now we simply have a collective, and we occasionally, I put out shows regularly myself, and some others do too. So that's the story with us.
Wow.
I'm going to roll on you because I got someone waiting, and because I'm having a hard time standing up over any length of time here.
Yeah, you're great, man.
Yeah, let me give you a card.
Huh?
Power relationships in this world are such that most of the people prosecuted by the International Court of Justice for war crimes have been from Africa. Some of those power relationships have shown themselves again in recent years, since South Africa has led the prosecution effort against Israel, charging Israel with genocide, among other crimes. The response to these charges from most of the West has been mostly a deafening silence. The only European countries that have joined South Africa in the case have been Spain and Ireland. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has put a lot of airtime and executive power into punishing South Africa for their principled stance, economically and in other ways as well. Itsuno thanks South Africa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Since South Africa won freedom, she always stood by Palestine. Against colonial forces, genocidal by design. So after the ghetto uprising, when the war on Gaza began, against all of the people, every child, woman, man, South Africa charged Israel with crimes against humanity to prosecute war criminals at the ICC. South Africa lived with apartheid. If people learned anything, they learned that no one else should ever suffer this way. Maybe that's why South Africa was the first to take action, to go to the World Court and start the prosecution. South Africa charged Israel with crimes against humanity to prosecute war criminals at the South Africa told by the President of the United States to remain silent and let Israel make the Middle East great. The Trump administration sanctioning as they will, but South Africa is seeking justice still. South Africa charged Israel with crimes against humanity to prosecute war. She always stood by Palestine.
Catch it here and now or never.
We have Isaac Collins doing some poetry. Go ahead, Isaac.
I honor and respect my elders. Like when I saw you on Thanksgiving, we had a conversation that was uplifting. The energy is the spirit of the people that are not here. Rest in peace to those ones that you lost in your family. We honor them and give them candles around the earth. The ones that are sleeping on the streets, we show them love for we understand for what they're worth. As a youth, I paid my dues for 19 years by respecting elders like you and you and doing something of true. But it takes the elders to support the youth so we can keep this legacy alive. Sometimes it feels like we're suffering through genocide in our hearts and souls because no one listens enough. But when I hear the elders that take time to listen to youth like me, these words become out of my soul and they become free. No more prisons, only love to rise above all of this. Even when our politicians don't give a crap about us in our city, they'll keep gentrifying us by raising the rent, giving us food that has no chemicals, but we'll keep supporting Food Not Bombs and Robert Norris and all those people that are doing the real work and not being fake activists in our community. So I give respect to my elders. I give them flowers. The ones that are living or not living, they still live inside of me. I just use my creativity for something that is energy.
And what would you want? What would you like to call that one, lyrical eye?
Respect elders and serenity.
And this poem is, of course, dedicated to you.
Yes, dedicated to you.
Because she's the one who spent some time actually talking to you at Thanksgiving. Yes. I had little patience.
Me, both of y'all. But, you know, I always, you know, we had like a really good vibe that day, Thanksgiving, and that really touched me. It touched me so much. I went to the ocean and I cried like the night after because I was like, I was open. I opened myself up to people. But it wasn't just about being an artist. It was about just talking and just relaxing. You know? And sometimes I have to learn that about myself because when you're on stage and you're in front of a lot of people, you have a persona. And that day, I didn't care about persona. I just cared about being there and present and just trying to listen and give something of myself. And I gave a lot of myself that day because I was there the whole day for Thanksgiving.
But did you get it back?
Oh, yeah, I always get back. It's not always sometime when I give something to receive. I'm just happy that I have a talent and hopefully people receive it in a way that's good, you know. But I'll say this. I'm always happy the things I do because I never thought that I'll be doing this for 19 years in this city. Never thought I'd make it to 42 to have a gift to do this, you know. And I'm not doing it bad. I'm not using cuss words. I'm not disrespecting my elders.
I'm
uplifting my elders. But I'm not just one example. I'm helping out the younger generations uplift their elders too. And that is where I feel like I'm winning.
Well, you young whippersnappers always trying something, I'll tell you that.
I'm just saying, at 42 years old, you know, when you guys met me, I was 19 years old. I mean, no, 22 years old. And I was houseless on these streets. I had missing teeth. I had a passion. I was performing in these streets. And if it wasn't for like elders like y'all putting a couple dollars in my pocket to help me eat better food, then who knows where I would have been. I mean, I would have been somewhere, but let's just be real. I lost my mom when I was 8. I lost my father 5 years ago. I lost like 10 of my aunties in the last 10 years. And I don't have that much. But what I do have, I honor that. That's why I give my flowers to the elders and show that. Because one day I don't want to feel like I get older and I don't feel like I'm not doing enough in every age. Yeah, I'm 42. I'm young. But am I doing it right? And so,
only you know that, my son.
I know. So that's why I use my art. And that's why I love sharing and just being aware of things. And I appreciate the work you do by giving me knowledge, giving me stuff to read so I can sit at my...
It'll be a small test next time I see you.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Again, we've been talking with...
Isaac, a.k.a. Lyrical Eye, an artist, a person that cares about the community, and just keep doing this.
Do Black Lives Matter in Santa Cruz? I ask a man whose skin is notoriously non-white.
Do Black Lives Matter? We're still here. I matter. Black lives do matter. And it's, you know, but it's bigger than just that. It's how do lives matter in a city that values that? You know, do Black lives matter in Santa Cruz? That's a 50-50. It matters.
You think it's a 50? That's very generous of you, you know.
It's a 50-50, but let's just be real with it. There's only 2% black, right? And there's only 3 or 4 black people here in this place right now, okay? And Santa Cruz, I mean, it is what it is. Like, for me, when I walk in spots, I feel it. But people know who the fuck I am.
The main part of your audience, mainly black or white, and when throughout the time. I mean, well, do you spend much time around black groups that say, well, hey, Santa here Cruz, comes Isaac Collins, or do they say something else?
Well, in Santa Cruz, I love to spend time with my black people, but they're at the university. I have to go where they are. But
black people around here somewhere.
Yeah, it goes back and forth. When I go to perform in open mics, I perform a lot in front of a bunch of white people, and sometimes I get tired of that. That's why I don't like to go out and perform that much.
Tired of us white guys? What are you, a racist? You're going to get it, man.
It's not getting tired of the race. It's just when you're performing for the same people, it feels like you just dilute yourself. Because, like, I don't know how many times white people want to hear black people's problems or that stuff. This is going to get tired. And I get tired of it. So when I go perform for, like, an Oakland or a different audience, then it's a different response I get. And I'll say this. Santa Cruz, yeah.
I mean, is there a black audience for you here in Santa Cruz at all?
That's a 50-50. That's a 50-50 because I have to be in those spaces more.
I mean, do you go to, I don't know, church gatherings where I don't think a lot of UCSC students go, but I imagine there's a black audience that goes there.
Yes. I used to go to a lot of black churches until it felt it was really cliquey and stuff. But I do like to go support the churches and stuff because that is where the youth is. And then at the UC...
Every year or so, they actually give you a meal. Isn't that amazing?
I mean, that, we won't say names about that church.
Why not?
I know what you're talking about, meals, but it's like... It can't just be just do you give a meal out once a year and you expect you're doing something. See, a lot of people do that. And they expect, you got to keep giving on. That's why I grew up in a church, but I do not go to church no more. But I read the Bible.
Black people are very dangerous, and that's why we can't do it all the time. You know,
black people are dangerous in certain ways, but I think people have a lot of fear of us when they don't understand our hearts or what the things we've been through. Like in Santa Cruz, people probably have a little fear when they see a black man that's a strong black man that doesn't take shit from nobody, which is like a person like me. I'm strong, but I hold myself in that way. Am I in more black circles in Santa Cruz? I could be, but I don't go out of my way to reach out. People know who I am. They see me. I'm everywhere. I do performances. I represent blackness. I go out and talk about blackness in my lyrics. So I just do my part to represent something, you know? And the next year, I'll have 20 years in my craft.
But now, I'm going to do my part by saying, happy trails to you.
And thank you again.
Look, man, you got cold hands.
I'm sorry, I talk a lot.
Over the course of decades of involvement with the movement in solidarity with the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people, David is one of many people whose experiences have led them to question Mossad's involvement with so many unsolved crimes, and even large-scale acts of terrorism, assassinations, kidnappings, and state capture. Sam Husseini has written various articles on Substack recently, questioning the potential role of Israeli leaders in the very untimely deaths of three different Kennedys. Of course, just asking the question, who killed the Kennedys, is enough to get you labeled a conspiracy nut of some kind, but we're way past worrying about such accusations.
So many years ago today, a president was shot. After all this time, no one has uncovered the plot. They talk about lone shooters. Who wants to explicate how his brother and his son met the same fate? So many unanswered questions, so many inquiries blocked. One after another, people who know one by one getting clocked. JFK tried to stop Israel from getting nuclear weapons. Who has investigated exactly how they eventually got them? We still wanna know who killed the Kennedys and where in the world did they go? And when Robert was killed on that awful day in June, after his brother's assassin had been killed by the Irgun, and then this hypnotized Palestinian, the bullets RFK was sent after he tried to label AIPAC as a foreign agent. We still wanna know who killed the Kennedys and where in the world did they go? Wasn't long before the young man wasn't around. Killed in an explosion, took his plane out in midair. No one ever
question staring us in the face. But even bothering to ask one, and they'll call you a disgrace. They'll call you.